If anyone else would like to sign in to speak at Democracy Day, please come up and sign in.
Are you?
Before we begin Democracy Day, I want you to be aware that our mayor, Jerry Fiala, passed away yesterday. Jerry's roots were in this community. He was born and bred in Kent, Ohio. He referred to himself as a townie. His love for his hometown community was reflected in his dedicated service to this community. He was proud of Kent's economic development that was made possible while he served as our mayor. He helped to make Kent the best city to live in and the best city to visit in Northeastern Ohio. Jerry leaves big shoes to fill for our future mayor. Over the past 16 years as mayor, even in illness, he worked tirelessly for our community. Jerry and I would often sit, we sat next to each other and we would often talk about family. And we would talk about our grandchildren and our children. And his love of his family was so strong. His wife, his children, and his grandchildren. Jerry will be greatly missed, not only by his family, but by us, his colleagues, and certainly by the community. The bottom line was that Jerry wasn't just the mayor of Kent. He was our friend. Godspeed, my friend. Let's have a moment of silence, please. Kathy, would you please read roll for Democracy Day?
Mr. Amrine?
Here.
Ms. Selka?
Here.
Mr. Clapper?
Here.
Mr. De Leon?
Here.
Mr. Hook?
Here.
Ms. Rosenberg?
Here.
Ms. Schaefer-Bish? Mr. Sidoti? Mr. Turner?
Mr. Turner, Mr. Sidoti, and Ms. Schaefer-Bish asked to be excused. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Good evening, everyone. I'm Jack Amrine. I'm the President Pro Tem of Kent City Council. Thank you for joining us tonight for the city's annual Move to Amend hearing, also known as Democracy Day. The purpose of this hearing is to examine the impact on our city, state, and nation of the political influence by corporate entities and big money in connection with the most recent election, which would have been 2024. Corporate entities include corporations, political action committees, PACs, super PACs, 501c4 groups, and unions. The Move to Amend hearing is established by Article 12, Section 5 of the Kent Codified Ordinances. This meeting is held annually. We take public comments and will have a written record and will be sending a copy to our elected representatives. Please, when you come up to address council, stay on topic. State your name and address and provide a copy of your statement for the clerk of council. Each person will have 5 minutes to state their opinion. Thank you. Kathy.
First up is John Kuhar.
I'll give you a break. I don't think I'm going to take 5 minutes.
If I can't read my own writing, I won't even take two. My name's John Kuhar. I live at 5751 Glad Boulevard in Kent. Some of you might remember me. I was on council here for 17 years. Just a little bit of history, a little corporate stuff. In the late 60s and 70s, I kind of took a little extra interest on what was going on in the world. And I know Jeff Clapper's mom was right there. You know, same thing, we're getting involved. I found myself participating in nonviolent demonstrations. I went to places like Washington, D.C., Selma, Alabama, Columbus, Ohio, Berkeley, California, and ended up here. Believe it or not, we had demonstrations in Kent, Ohio in 1970. I ran a bar downtown Kent on North Water Street, became nationally famous. It was a kind of a boiling point for political news. It was called Walter's Cafe, or some people call it Orville's. When I was running that place, I had a friend that worked, or that was going to school at Kent State, and he was studying corporate growth, how corporations were getting involved in other things. And it was interesting because he showed me a diagram of some of the corporations that were involved, and I'm not going to name them all, but there were General Electric, DuPont, the big three car companies, Standard Oil, and just a handful of corporations, probably less than 50. These corporations had money, ties, and influence on thousands of other corporations. At that point, we realized that it wasn't just about the corporations making money. The corporations had control of the economy, which in turn had control on our lifestyles, how we lived, what we did, the price we had to pay for food is how we reacted. And that was all, it started in a handful, and I'm sure it's got a lot worse since then. You know, I was raised to believe in the Constitution of the United States, the Bill of Rights. And I want to live in a country where it's a government by the people, for the people, and of the people. And I made a commitment then and still to do everything in my power to defend the rights that people have, the rights of assembly, freedom of speech, and everything else that our forefathers gave us. So when I was asked to run for council the first time, I jumped at it. I said, yeah, I want to be involved. I don't want to be a complainer. I want to be a helper. I didn't even know you got paid. You know, that was a shock. It was kind of nice to use it for extra gas money, because it sure wasn't much. But anyhow, here I am after 17 years in council, retired for a couple of years. I miss it. I think there's more left in me. You know, my grandson asked me if I was too old to run. And I changed the subject and I asked him what he thought of fusion energy. And he had no idea what I was talking about. Yeah. So, you know, when you look at someone on council, you need new blood, you need young people, you need new ideas, and you need new thoughts. But you also need people that can look to the future, you know, people that still have old school values and morals. And, you know, some of these smart kids learned it from somebody. And so you need both. You need someone that can have common sense. You need someone that can get up there and not want to waste money, so they have to be frugal. And you need someone that's willing to fight for the rights of people, whether they like them or not, and someone to keep government under control so government and corporations don't rule. People control government and corporations, and it's got to be a blend. It can't be one-sided. And we are really, with some of these big companies, we're really leaning one-sided. I don't think we can change that in the city of Kent. But as one woman that I don't particularly care for said, we do it one person or one village at a time. With that, you know, I know what it is to struggle. I know what it is to work hard, and I know what it is not to waste. So I'm running for council in November, and I wish that some of you that remember me will support me in that venture. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Bill Cullum is next.
My name is Joe Cullum. I am a recent move-in to Kent. I live on 434 Stowe Street. It's the red house that replaced the blue house that sat there empty for a long time. I have some history in Kent. I was a student here from 68 to 71, and I finally made it back after 54 years. I'm a retired high school social studies teacher. For the majority of my career, I taught government and economics to seniors. Since many of my students were 18 or soon to be 18, I worked with the County Board of Elections to register these eligible students as new voters. Some students were hesitant to register for fear of being called for jury duty. Others simply stated that they doubted that their vote mattered because of the billionaires and corporations had already determined the outcome of national elections. I had a difficult time making the case that all votes are important since two Supreme Court decisions, Buckley versus Vallejo and Citizens United versus the Federal Elections Commission, undermined my argument. These two decisions have determined that money is speech and corporations are persons. My belief is that this sentiment that the choice of the voters is undermined by the influence of corporations and billionaires shows itself in the dismal voter turnout rate that we see in the United States. In 2024, Donald Trump had the highest popular vote total in history with 77.5 million votes, which might be something to celebrate if 89 million eligible voters hadn't decided not to bother voting at all. The voter turnout rate has hovered in the 60% range for the past four presidential elections. The turnout rate in midterm congressional elections has been in the area of 50%. I am reminded of the response attributed to Benjamin Franklin when he was asked after the Constitutional Convention what kind of government had been created. He was said to have responded, "A republic, if you can keep it." The evidence is piling up that we may not be able to keep a government by and for the people. One step in keeping it would be the passage of the 28th Amendment.
Thank you.
Bill Weiland.
Bill Weiland, 867 Stonewater Drive in Kent. Anything else? That's enough. Okay. Democracy Day is all about advocating for the passage of the 28th Amendment to the Constitution. This We the People Amendment is about ending corporate constitutional rights and making clear that money is not speech. Instead of focusing in on different areas as I've done over the past 9-10 years now, I want to approach this issue by focusing on you, City Council. Here's the question I use for my information source. How can the city of Kent, Ohio benefit if money is not considered speech and corporations are not considered people? First area is more representative local democracy. Equal voice for residents. Without large corporations or wealthy donors treating money as speech, Kent residents' voices can carry a lot more weight in local elections, town halls, and policy debates. Also, less influence of outside money. Corporate PACs or wealthy individuals from outside Kent can have less sway over city council campaigns or ballot initiatives. Two, fair local elections, local campaign costs. Candidates would not need raised massive sums to compete, making it easier for everyday Kent residents, teachers, small business owners, community leaders to run for office. More issue-driven campaigns or debates would focus more on community needs, zoning, housing, infrastructure, sustainability, other than donor interests. Number three, better policy outcomes for residents. Development decisions, zoning and land use choices like the industrial to residential zoning recently debated over the last month by council. Environmental protections, local ordinances on clean water, green space, and renewable energy would be harder for corporate lobbyists to block. Stronger local economy. Support for small businesses with less corporate dominance. Kent would encourage policies that favor local entrepreneurs, co-ops, and independent businesses that reinvest services locally. Fair competition. Corporate personhood often allows big companies to use lawsuits or lobbying to push out smaller competitors. Without it, Kent's small business ecosystem would thrive. And number five, greater community trust in government, transparency and accountability. Residents would see that local government decisions are based on community needs, not hidden donations or lobbying, and higher civic engagement. People are more likely to vote, volunteer, and participate when they feel their voice matters as much as corporations. In short, Kent would likely see fairer elections, more community-centered policies, a stronger local economy, and greater trust in government if money weren't speech and corporations weren't people. One initiative in Kent that demonstrates how the people benefit over corporate interests is rezoning of industrial land to residential. My data source described the Gray Fox Capital's proposal to use two parcels of land on Franklin Avenue to build a large rental development bordering the railroad tracks. Kent's Planning Commission unanimously rejected the rezoning, citing concerns about contamination, traffic, and affordable housing. Council also agreed, but also passed a motion to explore overlay zoning that would allow residential construction under certain conditions in the future. No decision has been made at this time. So there's where we are. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
Greg Coleridge.
Good evening. I'd like to first extend my condolences to all of you for the loss of your colleague. My name is Greg Coleridge. I'm the co-director of the National Move to Amend campaign 3016 Somerton Road in Cleveland Heights. The seasons change, the years change, political administrations change, but the power of corporations to rule and the corrupting influence of big money elections from the super rich have not changed. Okay, maybe of degree or magnitude, but certainly not of kind. Legalized bribery is alive and well, and it's bipartisan. The Harris political campaign outraised the Trump campaign in the 2024 elections, both over $1 billion. Super PAC and dark money political contributions, actually more like investments, to independent organizations were massive, which favored Trump. Billionaires in industries like those peddling cryptocurrencies definitely favored Trump. If anything stands out, however, this time around, it's the clear, flagrant, and boastful return on political campaign investments. More billionaire donors than ever in the Trump cabinet. Billions in federal contracts flowed to SpaceX, run by mega Trump supporter Elon Musk, while Doge vacuumed up massive amounts of personal data from federal agencies to profit Musk. The crypto industry, which poured millions into the Trump effort, now boasts a strategic Bitcoin reserve and a national digital asset stockpile. The private prison industry has cashed in on the corporatization of immigrant detention and deportation policies. Cuts to Medicare and SNAP have been paired with likely backdoor reductions to Medicare, opening the door to further healthcare corporatization to the delight of insurance corporations that funded Trump. Corporate campaign cash has yielded the ending of over 100 DOJ criminal investigations or enforcements of corporations. And a Trump executive order has allowed now $12 trillion in workplace retirement funds to be steered into private equity firms and cryptos. The list goes on, but I've only got 5 minutes. Corporate entities have hijacked constitutional rights intended exclusively for human beings that goes well beyond the so-called rights of corporations to donate money in elections. Corporations now wield the First Amendment right not to speak, Fourth Amendment search and seizure protections, Fifth Amendment takings rights, and 14th Amendment due process and equal protection rights. You want to talk about authoritarianism? Try doing anything that fundamentally asserts the power communities or to ensure a livable world, and watch what happens. Corporations will claim their constitutional rights are being violated. Those claims routinely override the rights of residents and the duty, like yourself, of public officials to protect the health, safety, and welfare. At present, we don't have much recourse. Nothing will change, ever, if all we are concerned about is changing elected officials, laws, or regulations, but not our fundamental undemocratic rules. Good luck trying to treat unhealthy leaves, branches, or a trunk of a tree if the roots are rotten. We must democratize our undemocratic Constitution and Supreme Court decisions. There are many, but a key one is to abolish the judge-made doctrines that assert money equals free speech and a corporation is a person. The one and only proposal at the moment that achieves both these doctrines is H.R. 54, the We the People Amendment. Voters of Kent were wise in 2015 when 64% of voters called for Congress to abolish these undemocratic doctrines. That was an excellent start. But we all must do more, particularly given where we are today. For our part, it's gathering more signatures. I have a petition that I'll pass around with information that'll go your way. Collect more organizational endorsements and seek more local resolutions. That's what we're doing. We've begun, in fact, to try to reach out to county councils as well. However, I ask council, there's something that you can do as well to reach out to your peers in adjoining communities, to join the 26 other political jurisdictions in Ohio, cities, towns, and villages to pass a similar resolution. The history of this country is crystal clear. Nothing fundamental changes for the good unless there is a people's movement behind it. Just look at the growing street action supporting democracy, which in part includes opposing corporate power and big money in elections. We are part of that movement, but so are you. We continue to take actions to broaden and deepen the growing awareness that human rights, people's rights, and community rights are more sacred than corporate rights. We are doing our part. We ask you to do yours. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a handout that you don't mind.
Pass around and give a background as to the Supreme Court decisions expanding corporate power.
Fred Pierre.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak. And I'm sorry to hear about Harry. So we have a government shutdown right now, and that is partially due to illegal behavior by the president, illegal rescissions in the budget, and impoundments that are blocking funds that have been allocated by Congress to the necessary functions of government. So when you try to approve a budget, but the president won't agree to stick to the congressional budgeting and decision making, then it's very hard to come up with a agreement to fund the government. Now, I'm going to suggest that a lot of our problems are coming from what I'm calling a wealth inequality tipping point. And that has to do with some people running away with a lot of money to become trillionaires. And we'll see that in the next year or two, probably the first trillionaires. If we don't do a couple of things, we're going to have some serious problems, and other people have mentioned those things tonight. I believe that we need a litmus test for politicians, and a lot of people are saying don't give a litmus test, but I think we need to ask politicians to agree to tax the billionaires, to end the Citizens United decision that gave corporations the rights of people, and to ensure healthcare access for everyone. Cost of healthcare is skyrocketing. People can't afford it. Businesses are going out of business. And we need to have healthcare access for everyone. We can throw in, you know, stopping the genocide, but I think those three points are things that if we don't ensure healthcare, the ending of corporations as people and taxing the billionaires, we're going to have some real problems. So, you know, we could reform the Electoral College too. I'd like to read something that I wrote about a hero of democracy. It's actually about Russia, where you can't speak about the war in Ukraine or you go to jail for 7 years. You can't report on the war in Ukraine or you'll be put in jail. You can't even be a lawyer for those people who've been accused. The lawyers are going to jail too. So we need to look at that and think about it. Do we want that kind of situation in our country? So I'm talking about Alexei Navalny, one of the heroes of the democracy movement in Russia. I'm just going to read something I wrote about this. Navalny, maybe you had us all fooled, but I believe you were the real deal. An honest man in a dishonest world, in a society captivated by fear. You started out as a businessman. You encountered corruption, bribery, payoffs, and kickbacks. You reported it, so you were arrested. You ran for mayor on a platform of anti-corruption. You challenged the party incumbent and won a quarter of the vote. Troublemaker, your team of journalists investigated the rich and the powerful, exposing public corruption and the misuses of government funds. What we felt was your love for Yulia, for your children, for your country, which you never threw under the bus. We have all the tools right here to be free. We have people who care, people who hope, people who vote. Give us a choice to rely on. When someone speaks truth, you can trust them to love you. Surrendering self is the key to both worlds. The sense of self-sacrifice, Jesus did it for love. That caring citizens do nothing is not an option for folks like Navalny, who believe, as I do, that we all dwell in freedom. Do you hide in the shadows, put your mask on, and look like you like what you're doing? The populist, paid politicians, master is pulling the strings, cross him and you'll end up compost. You made fun of the system, but never mocked Jesus or human rights, which you held up as sacred. There was something disarming about you. It was your keen sense of humor. No one put their guard up as you dismantled the system. You appeared more solid than the Kremlin phantasms. Authenticity walking, you looked folks in the eye without flinching, with kindness and compassion. They took you from us, took our touchstone, took our emblem, took our embodiment. Now we must plant a million trees, plant a million Navalny's. We can change the world if we all pick up shovels and dig our way out of this darkness. The pit they have thrown us all into, the gulag, solitary confinement and screen capture, mass surveillance and early detection. You are Winston in 1984, the one who escaped in mind and in spirit, if never in body. Death isn't real, you said. It looks different from the other side, like we've lost you, but there you are, lighting a million candles. There you are, wonderfully free. Throw open cages, resurrect opposition to shameless theft and rampant corruption. I won't pay my bribe, won't participate in a system that doesn't respect me. The sorcerer wields dark magic, but fear never wins in the end. The dictator dies, because all of them do. Then together we'll rebuild our society. Together we'll rebuild our trust. Thank you for sharing the roadmap. And thank you for listening. Have a good day.
Thank you, Fred.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that would like to speak on the topic of the Democracy Day? Sir?
John Thomas, 1621 Chadwick Road here in Kent. I marched in my first pro-democracy, pro-civil rights march in Kent on Main Street when I was 11 years old. And I was there because my father was there as a member of UAW. Kent has always been historically a bright, shining light, as the speakers have already spoken to, as far as it comes to democracy and the worth of one's civil rights. I'm here to testify for that. I've, my entire life, worn civil rights and democracy as a third layer of my skin. And I live with it. I know all of you live with it and treasure it and don't want it taken away from us. Scientists used to have, maybe still do, a nuclear clock. And typically the nuclear clock was set no further back than 5 minutes till midnight. I haven't heard in a while, no surprise, if we still have that nuclear clock and who's managing it, and if we do, where that clock is between 11:55 and 12 midnight. And I wonder if the same thing, is it come time to have a democracy clock? And if we do, how close is that democracy clock moving to midnight, the darkness of night, when democracy no longer breathes in this country? I wish all of you well. My sympathies to Jerry. I was on council with Jerry when he was first appointed in June of 1984, and he will be missed. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, John. Control him.
What's that? Who get the group? Oh, that's what a major.
I'd like to thank everybody who participated today. Thank you for your words. Thank you for your hope and your commitment. I didn't have time to prepare anything. So, yeah. Okay, so we're going to move on to our committee meeting. I'll call the committee meeting of October 1st, 2025 to order. The first topic on the agenda is Committee of the Whole Sustainability Month Proclamation.
I'm going to read this proclamation.
Kathy, would you read the proclamation? Thank you.
I'm going to read this proclamation regarding Sustainability Month, signed by Jerry Fiala. Whereas the City of Kent recognizes the well-being of a community is directly linked to the health of our planet, and the Kent community has a long history of working to protect and enhance the environmental, health, and social well-being of those who live, work, and play in the city. And whereas cities across the nation are at the forefront of building a more resilient future by enacting initiatives related to renewable energy, energy efficiency, waste reduction, transportation, and urban green spaces that offer numerous benefits such as cost savings, improved public health, and enhanced quality of life for all residents. And whereas the City of Kent is committed to implementing policies and practices designed to preserve and protect the Kent community through a commitment to ongoing responsible environmental stewardship. And whereas to honor this commitment, the City of Kent, with the help and input of the community, adopted a Climate Action Plan, CAP, in April 2023, which identified strategies aimed at reducing greenhouse gas emissions, a key contributor to climate change. And whereas the City of Kent recognizes the importance of implementing these strategies and continuing to work together as a community to raise awareness of how individual and collective action can lead to a healthier, sustainable, and more resilient future. Now, therefore, I, Jerry Fiala, Mayor and President of the City Kent City Council, in alignment with the education and outreach component of the CAP, do hereby proclaim the month of October 2025 as Sustainability Month in the City of Kent, Ohio. All residents, businesses, and organizations are urged to join the celebration by participating in activities that promote sustainable practices. Working together can create a bright, more sustainable future for the City of Kent and beyond.
Thank you, Kathy. Staff updates, Chief Samuels.
Mr. Mayor, as we are, as Jamie's coming up, we had some heavy news with the mayor, and we had some heavy discussion with the corporate scene. I am pleased that Jamie came in my office and said, I have a point of light I want to share in this dark time. And so he's here to introduce a young Kent resident who was instrumental in working with one of our dispatchers to help save a life. So we get to celebrate that. So Jamie.
Yes, thank you for the nice introduction. So in the back row, I have a shining star of the Kent community. Her name is Destiny Tolbert, and she performed well in a recent emergency that involved her mother at home. So you can see in the back row a bunch of cameras. She is supported here by her stepfather, Robert, and a small army of siblings, 7-year-old Journey, 9-year-old King, 11-year-old Robert, and 20-year-old Haywood. These siblings were there when Anita, Destiny's mother, was having a seizure at home. And Destiny took charge, not like a 13-year-old girl, but probably like a 30-year-old adult. And that is why she stood out to us, dispatch and the fire department. And we believe that something like this is a sign of a shining star in the community, and we should recognize that. And that's why she's here today. very well deserving. And I didn't even say anything extra special about her yet. As I talked to Anitra, Destiny's mother, she told me that Destiny is in the eighth grade at Stanton Middle School. She is involved with the orchestra where she plays violin. She does the morning announcements. So standing up here front and center is nothing short of what she's used to every day, right? She loves to read and watch movies in her free time in between calling in emergencies and helping save lives. So I want to present her with a Fire Chief's Award for Citizenship and Courage today. And so let me read you what this award says, and it kind of fills in the details about what happened that day. On August 4th of 2025 at approximately 5:18 p.m., Destiny Tolbert recognized her mother having a medical emergency at their home. Destiny quickly recognized that her mother was having a seizure and administered medication by syringe in her mother's nostrils that she had only learned days earlier to give in an attempt to stop the seizure activity. Then her quick thinking recognized the need for EMS. She dialed 911 and summoned the paramedics to respond to take care of her mother. While talking to emergency dispatchers, Destiny remained calm, focused, and responded to direct questions from dispatchers that provided updated information on her mother's condition for paramedics. While this occurred, other younger children, those that I introduced, could be heard in the home, and they were scared and crying. Destiny was able to tell her older brother, Haywood, to safely get the younger children to another room so they wouldn't be frightened, and she could hear the directions from the emergency dispatcher. After a few minutes, paramedics arrived and fortunately quickly treated and transported Destiny's mother, Anitra, to the hospital. For her actions, Destiny Tolbert, 13-year-old Destiny Tolbert, is hereby awarded the Fire Chief's Award for Citizenship and Courage. Her actions demonstrated her knowledge, her courage, and her ability to recognize and perform under stressful emergency conditions. Without Destiny's quick actions, her mother's condition may have worsened. There is no doubt Destiny made the difference. Congratulations, Destiny, on a job well done. Your family and community are proud of you. So I've given Destiny a framed Chief's Award, and I'm also giving her a challenge coin. And she's got support from the school here. Thank you.
I think we have Jim trying to follow that. Good luck, buddy. Oh, that's great. Thank you so much for being here.
Good evening, everyone. I'm just going to give a short update on the construction on East Main Street. So not as exciting as the earlier topic. So first off, I'd like to let you know what the contractor is working on. They're doing the underground work. When we build a road, the first thing they do is build everything underneath it. Okay, they're going to be doing that for another 2 to 4 weeks in the area that they're working. After that, you should see curb go in, grading. It's going to start going to look like a road in that area. So they've been doing really good. They've had two crews out there working. We're coordinating with Dominion, First Energy, AT&T. They all have to come in and move their facilities as well. So that's been working well. The next thing is to give you an update on traffic management. Okay. We're actively monitoring traffic, not just on Main, but on Crane and on Summit Street as well. So in doing this, not just monitoring it, we are continually adjusting the signal systems on Main Street with the goal to move traffic on Main as much as possible without delaying traffic. That way they stay off the side roads, being especially the Crane Avenue neighborhood, which was a common cut through before we started construction. Some of the things that we've done already, we've already added green, we've overridden the system. We add green time now and set how long it's going to be. We're actively trying to optimize the signal so there's no wasted green time. No one likes it when you're driving and you're stuck at a red light and there's a green light over here and there's no one coming. And that's just in a normal situation. But in this situation, it feels like a real wasted time. So we found numerous issues with the system. For example, one of our preemption devices that detect when a fire vehicle is coming through was failing and it was giving false calls. So turning the signals to red in directions, even when there was no need to. So that happened actually the first week we started work. So we had to fix that to keep things moving. So we're continuing to look at those areas and we have other changes that we can make to optimize it. And again, try to move traffic and keep them off the side roads. On the communication side of things, I'll speak on the outgoing communication. You all get email updates that we basically knocked on doors. Anyone who wants to get an update receives an update. We've got an email list of over 100 people at this moment. You've seen the changeable message boards out there to let people know directly driving what's going on, how to best get through the area. Dominique's helping with social media updates. If you go on our website, there's updates that continuously get added to that. And basically, anytime we get an opportunity to speak to people about what's going on, we take that up to let them know. Incoming communications or complaints, questions and those kind of things. We've gotten several. Just touch on a couple that have come up that might be pertinent. One of the best ones is, why did we start construction the first week of school starting? That was never the intent. Okay. We were planning on starting 2 months earlier. However, issues with funding and bidding delayed it for a couple months. So we still had to get started so that we can get the road in place before winter, or portions of the road in place before winter. So we've had other comments having to do with the messages on the message boards, and we've actually changed the messages to be more understandable to the public. We've moved some of them because as the drivers experience them, they're like, this isn't working well. So that continues to work every day. We've got a large team helping out with this, from the contractor to the construction management firm to our staff. So, and we're all working right now to try to get a good start on this project that's going to last us several years. So.
Thanks, Jim.
Mm-hmm. And Melanie is going to offer a few quickies too. She's been out of town, right? So I wasn't sure you were going to make it back, but she made it back. We're delighted. So go ahead, Melanie.
Perfect. I'll make these real quick. As most of you know, Tuesday, September 23rd, the city of Kent experienced a very large power outage, pretty much north to south, east to west, and it floated around during the entire day. But two departments or divisions that I really want to kind of bring to the forefront is your water plant as well as your water reclamation facility. The water plant lost power around 2 a.m. They then had to bring crews in to be able to hook up their backup generator, which actually brings up their entire plant. It's a very large underdoing. It's a very large generator. Quite frankly, I've only seen them put it into work once. I don't ever need to see it again. It's that scary. Literally, it's one of those plugs that's this big and three people carry it in to plug it in. They were able to get the plant back up and continually running within about 45 minutes. So we never lost a beat. We were able to continue to supply our water and we never had to take a transfer from Ravenna. My hats are off to John and all the guys that were able to keep that going. They never received power back until around 9:30 that evening. The water reclamation facility, if you didn't know, Bill Schesventer, what a great time, retired 2 weeks prior to this. So our interim, which is our chief operator, TJ Grippy, was there. They actually lost power at 5 a.m. Something unique with that facility is we have a dual feed. We have a feed coming from Akron and a feed coming from Ravenna. Believe it or not, both feeds went down within 20 minutes of each other. That started at 5 a.m. and they never regained power until 12:05 a.m. the next day. This is pretty big for that department because we have certain regulations that we have to maintain to keep oxygen in the water, the items flowing, and our primaries continuing to work. We don't have a large backup generator because backup power there was when one feed went down, the second feed usually could. This was a very unique situation because we lost both feeds. With that, they were able to start transferring stuff in, bringing some smaller generators from other divisions and keep up the necessary areas. So that while, yes, we did do a violation, it occurred late in the afternoon, which is pretty incredible. Prior to that, usually we would begin losing our bugs and our dissolved solids within about 4 hours of being without power. So they had been without power for almost 9 at that point. We did go from 7 to a 4 in our dissolved solids, but that is the only violation that we were able to have and have to report to the EPA. That's pretty miraculous considering the entire plant was down and they had to keep alternating from one to the other to keep the activities going. Again, our interim manager at the time did a great job. They actually brought people in because typically we don't have a third shift that fills. But that evening when we got the call, we brought people in and around the clock staff followed to make sure that we didn't lose anything. I'm pretty proud of these two groups because it was a big endeavor to keep that going almost 24 hours without power. Again, never losing a beat, not being able to treat these things and make sure that all of that happened. In addition to that, their daily work was continuing. So on the water side, we're still investigating all of our wells. We are very excited to say that two of our test holes, as you know, we began this year, look very, very promising. So we're hoping within the next 3 months as we monitor those, we'll be able to come to council and say we have a viability of a new well, which is very exciting. On the sanitary side, they continue to work with their digesters, their primary clarifier, and we just began 3 weeks ago looking at the design of their headworks. So again, some very good stuff. I wanted to just follow up on our asphalt program for the summer. I'm pretty pleased. If you guys remember, we came here, we had over 200. Yes, that was 200 work orders for potholes. We're down to 9. So I have to say that with your support and our ability to make sure that we dedicated a crew, gained some additional dollars, we were able to address a good portion of those. We're not out of the woods. We still have roads that are going to probably give us concerns over the winter. So I don't want to paint this rosy picture that we're one and done. But the guys did a really great job with that. With that being said, I do need to remind you, though, while we're still going to have about 2 weeks of good weather, we've had to switch our crews over to our brush chipping and, of course, our leaf vacuuming. Because as you see, our wonderful leaves for fall have begun to make their ways to the ground. But in addition to that, our crews were also able to get our catch basin work, our stormwater work, and our water work completed for this summer. So we're pretty happy. All of our hydrants were flushed and maintained. All of our valves were able to be turned. So despite taking time to make sure we could address those kinds of things, we were still able to keep some of the other stuff going as well. And finally, I'm really excited to say we have begun readying our trucks for snowplow season, and we are loading our salt shed with salt right now. We're going to try a new product this year. It's called GeoMelt, and it's actually a byproduct of beet production. I've had the opportunity to use that where I come from. It's biodegradable. It is very good for the environment. But the nice part, if we can treat the salts, we get less bounce out of it, so it stays more on the roads, meaning that we would have to use less of that. And if we can pre-treat with this as well, we're going to find that when we get down to those lower temperatures, 0 to about 20 degrees, they say it's good negative 20. I've never seen it get that cold around here, but 0 to 20, it does a great job for us so that we're able to make sure that we get that. Once we can get out there within 4 hours and apply salt on those pre-treated streets, we don't see ice build back up. So we're pretty excited with some of these new initiatives as we continue to move forward. And again, I thank council for your support in all of these items. Thank you.
Thanks, Melanie. Okay. Is that it? Okay. Community Development Committee, Ms. Roseberg.
Yes, thank you. We've got a sustainability coordinator update.
Yeah, it's always
I don't know, maybe because I like her, but it's really always great to see Julie. And I don't see her as much, I guess, because she's always out in the environment somewhere trying to take care of it, planting flowers and cleaning the air. And, you know, maybe that's a little more direct than what she actually does a lot of the time. But she administers, you know, our environmental programs, particularly the Climate Action Plan. So in this sustainability month, what better time to have an update from Julie? So thanks, Julie.
Thank you.
Oh, you need more time to cue it up? Want me to do a song and dance?
Right. Let's see.
Tell us more about cleaning the flowers again.
No, no. Maybe I can try the other side. And of course, Nick's not here, right?
We can still do it the old-fashioned way.
We can.
She can talk us through it. It's good news either way.
Hard copy.
Yeah, yeah.
Do it that way
too. Nick, unfortunately, isn't here tonight.
Yeah.
We do have your presentation in our packet. So.
Yeah.
Do you have copy? Can
I work on this
way? Yeah, I do. It's okay. No worries.
Technology.
All right.
Good.
Just give me a second here. I
will try Sorry about that. Those.
Okay. So,
but you're saving energy this way, less energy consumption on your laptop. It's all part of the pitch. I get it now. I see your genius at work.
I mean, I try. All right. Well, I guess I don't really need to introduce myself, but for those of you maybe who don't know me, I am Julie Morris, the city's sustainability coordinator, and I am here tonight to provide some project highlights of work coming out of the CAP. So I did want to, if you can go to. Okay, imagine the technology. All right. Okay, we'll regroup. We'll open this up. Give me 1 second here. It's okay. And all right, we'll pick up where we left off on that second slide here. I just wanted to give a quick refresher on that the city adopted a climate action plan in April 2023. It is a 5-year plan, and it has about 15 strategies to help us meet goals across these focus areas that you see here on the screen. Those strategies, of course, are being reviewed by staff for consideration for timing, funding, fit with city needs, all of those things as we move through implementation. I did want to note that our updated greenhouse inventory was completed. We wrapped that up beginning of last year. And what that did was help confirm that stationary energy and transportation sectors are our largest areas of emissions for the city. Stationary energy, by the way, is residential, commercial, like building industrial energy use. So really that helped us to prioritize strategies coming out of these sectors. Education outreach is integral to the implementation of the CAP. I mean, we need to let folks know what we're doing and why and where we are in that process. So strategies coming out of the education and outreach focus area have also been prioritized. I did want to note that that doesn't mean that we're not working on other areas of the CAP. All areas, you know, we are looking at all of that. In your packets, there is a detailed staff report that kind of details work happening across those areas. So if you get a minute to take a look at that later, that would be good as well. But for tonight's, the rest of tonight's focus, we're going to look at some highlights of projects coming out of these particular areas of the CAP. So part of the strategies for stationary energy emission reduction in the CAP are to look at expanding solar energy as well as supporting local grid capacity. So we are really excited to share that we are moving forward with exploring a solar project that will be sited at the 800 Mogador brownfield site. The city has hired Civil and Environmental Consultants, Inc. To help provide professional services associated with the design, installation, and implementation options for the array. And they'll also be advising us as to financing and kind of funding pathways for the potential project as well. It is a public-private project, and staff did have their first introductory meeting with the consultants last week. So, you know, as we move along and we get more information, we will be able to provide more updates as it becomes available to share. We're just really excited that, you know, there's not only the potential to meet various climate goals with this, but it's just an opportunity to see, you know, the moving of a currently vacant brownfield site toward productive use, which is always a good thing. So energy efficiency initiatives are also, you know, critically important to reducing stationary energy emissions. The CAP actually directs us to utilize the U.S. Department, the Environmental Protection Agency's Energy Star Portfolio Manager system as a tool within several different strategies in the CAP. So staff went ahead and we put together a portfolio of city facilities within this program. It's a free program too, by the way, which is a bonus. The city facilities were identified as being high energy users. So we put those together the tool. It helped us to learn the software program and also hopefully be able to lead by example as we move forward with that work. We could do an entire presentation just on the features of this program, but at its core, what it does is allow the city to track its energy use and benchmark that use as well. You can actually look at the properties at the individual facility level. It has the capacity to have you look at that energy use as a whole portfolio. You can actually even look at it as a grouping of facilities if you would like. That's kind of what you see on the screenshot there. And there are, there's hundreds of different metrics within the program that you can look at. But industry standards tend to look at what's called site energy use intensity, which is basically how much energy is being used at the facility itself in relation to the building size and also the building type, that it is. It also is able to help us track associated greenhouse gas emissions with that energy use. So, lots of different things that it can help us look at. It's got a variety of monetary metrics as well. And it has this neat comparison feature where you can actually look at kind of peer cities. So you could say, you know, based on you may have one facility that is a certain building type and size. You could look at a peer city that has a facility also of that same type and size. Then as a larger perspective, you could be looking at, well, you know, what are those cities doing for their climate work versus ours and how does that work? So there's lots of different ways to look at the information that is being input into the system. Our data for our portfolio is being tracked annually. Our baseline year is 2023. City Hall will be added to the portfolio. We just need to get a year's worth of utility bills together. That's where the energy data comes from for the program. So we will also be exploring the various reporting and target setting options that it offers for future use. But overall, you know, it really is just a great tool to kind of look at, you know, if ever repairs or upgrades or, you know, facility updates are made on existing buildings or performance of newer buildings is had, you can actually correlate that with energy, monetary, and emission savings over time. So it's a really, really neat tool. So I am not going to read through the sustainable design elements that you see on the screen, but I did feel it was important to note that City Hall was built to LEED Silver standards. And all of these design elements, you know, are integrated into the building to make it a very sustainable and efficient addition to this portfolio. So there are a lot of strategies available to help us reduce our transportation emissions. They're kind of divided into two core areas in the CAP, one looking at bike and walk infrastructure and the other looking at electric vehicle infrastructure. Within the bike and walk infrastructure, there's about six projects listed, and we are working closely with the city's engineering department to help support, promote, and provide education around those projects as needed. One of them actually was just recently completed this summer. You can see in the top picture there, that is the trail connector that connects the Freedom Trail with the Portage Hike and Bike Trail. So what it does is allow users to avoid that really curvy, steep section of Middlebury Road and sort of travel safely between the trails. So that's really exciting. If you haven't been out there, it is beautiful. I would recommend that you check it out. It's very cool. We are also... We are also very excited that we have submitted a renewal application with the League of American Bicyclists to renew our honorable mention status. And hopefully maybe increase our rating with their bicycle friendly community program. Part of that application process involves getting feedback on biking in our community via public survey that's administered by the league. So that actually has been running for a little while. It's due to wrap up this Sunday, actually October 5th. So if you haven't had a chance to take that survey yet, please do. We are expecting a rating decision in December, and with that decision, the league provides you a detailed report of not just the survey data, but then suggestions for how you can improve biking in your community. So we are excited to see where that goes. Within the electric vehicle infrastructure component, I'm sure you're all aware, with the East Main Street renovation project, there will be many EV stations going in as part of that, but we are thrilled to have the dual port level 2 EV charging stations installed and operational here at City Hall. Got some interesting metrics about that usage here. For the last 30 days, the average charging session length has been about an hour and a half. We've had, on average, about 15 to 20 sessions a month, although I did have a chance to peek at the data before I came, and we actually surpassed July's numbers in September. We were at 25 sessions, so that's encouraging, and what's interesting about that, too, is we're averaging between 5 and 10 unique drivers out of those sessions or so every month, and what that is that you know, you have users who are using the stations repeatedly, but then you also have new users coming in to use the stations. So it can track the difference between that. So we are hopeful that we'll just continue to see those numbers increase as we move along. The stations have already helped us avoid 508 kilograms of greenhouse gas emissions. And that's like planting 13 trees and letting them grow for 10 years. So they're already making a bit of a difference. There's been a lot of work going on in the education outreach area of the CAP. We are so happy to have our sustainability overview webpage up on the city's site. We would encourage you to visit it often. It's where we're able to put up a lot more detailed information about the work that we're doing, and we're able to update it with new pages, you know, as new programs are coming online. So that's been a really critical tool for us. Our sustainability community listserv is being out through the city's Civic Alert program. So we're actually up to about 189 subscribers now there. And that's been a great tool for just sending out, you know, some news blasts about sustainability activity happening in the area or things that the city is doing. So that's another tool at our disposal now. We are issuing the Sustainable Kent e-newsletter quarterly. We've been doing a lot of presentations and interviews, tabling at a lot of area events to help share about our CAP work. And we've really been working to foster a lot of local and regional collaboration. Some of that collaboration has helped us lay groundwork to explore the development of the City Business Organization Climate Alliance, that is an initiative directed by the CAP. And also as part of that work, we were invited by the Kent State University Design Innovation Hub Fellows Challenge. And we were awarded a team of students who will help develop a model for a sustainable Kent that we can use as an educational tool when talking about sustainability. So we're really excited about that. That project actually will run the entirety of the academic year. And we are looking forward to seeing what they give us in May. I did want to note, just to touch on work that the Sustainability Commission has been doing. They have been doing a lot of research on a variety of topics that helps with our information gathering around different CAP strategies. They have been undergoing a bylaws and ordinance review to align the group's activity with city's needs, especially given, you know, that we now have adopted a climate action plan. They've also really been instrumental in helping design and drive the October Sustainability Month activities as well. Speaking of October Sustainability Month, you're all familiar, I'm sure, with April being, you know, Earth Month, and a lot of sustainability activity happens then. Well, October is kind of like this quiet, not quiet, but a companion month, if you will, to that, and in the field. So we're hopefully looking to celebrate, you know, the many sustainable practices that our community engages in each and every day. We're hoping that by showcasing these efforts together, throughout the month, we'll be able to create a celebration as unique and special as Kent is as Kent itself. The Sustainability Commission will be tabling at the Haymakers Farmers Market on a Saturday in October. The commission has also been working with the city's Parks and Rec Department, along with some other wonderful community partners, to bring a lights out event to Plum Creek Park. That's going to be a really engaging evening where folks can come and learn about bird migration and nocturnal animals and sort of the impact of light pollution on some of those things. So it should be really fun. So I would encourage you to also visit the October Sustainability Month celebration webpage that we are have listed. It'll have more details and information for you there as well, and we will continue to update it as more activities become available. So I just wanted to give you a really brief timeline, kind of where we're headed. I am not going to read everything through this timeline, but essentially what we're doing, the work we've been talking about here tonight, work that you see in the staff report, we will be continuing that through the end of the year and into you know, years moving forward as needed. Transportation sector initiatives and stationary energy initiatives also will remain prioritized, but we're also going to start sort of turning attention and more attention to exploring some of those other areas of the CAP in detail as well over the next couple of years. So Also in that 2026-2028 timeframe, we most likely will undergo another greenhouse gas inventory update. That would help us assess where we, the progress we've made with our efficiency reduction strategies, and help us adapt any goals that we may have moving forward based on some of those results. So from 2029 to 2050, the city will undergo about, every 5 years or so, a climate action planning process, looking, and evaluating our goals, adapting them as needed to continue this work until we reach carbon neutrality. All of this work has to happen with collaboration and input from the community. You can see that described in the lower left paragraph there on your screen. And so that will continue throughout the implementation of the plan as well. So thank you very much for your time this evening. And please let me know if you have any questions.
Thanks. Thank you very much. Does council have any questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Julie.
Up next for Community Development Committee is the Brimfield Kent Jed Income Tax
Thank you, Julie.
Agreement. Renewal and amendment.
This is a repeat of what we had last month for Franklin Township. The agreement for the administration of the income tax is done in agreement between the City of Kent, because Budget and Finance Department works on that, and the actual JED board. So we were here last month with the Franklin one, and the Brimfield one got delayed because of getting a quorum for that meeting. They voted to approve the draft agreement that was presented to you, and it is a renewal. And it, like last month, the only additions is that it includes language to allow for the JED board to vote to use RITA for income tax collections going forward. That language was not in the prior agreement. I can take any questions.
Any questions from council? Any from the audience? Back to council.
I'll move to approve with emergency.
Second.
Any discussion?
Thank you.
All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passes. Thanks, Bridget.
Open the Finance Committee funding considerations to support Kent Parks and Recreation Department. Angela.
Yeah, so as you remember, Angela came, actually she kicked us off. She started the process back in June, where we started to say to you, got some big chunks that we're going to have to make some decisions on. And next month, Rhonda and I will sort of be circling back with you to say, all right, here's kind of like a summary of what you heard, costs. Maybe we'll have some sort of worksheet where you could start like saying, all right, what would you like to fund? How would you like to finance it? Depending on your feedback, we're not looking to solve it next month, but it's a process to help us start to zero in on how you wish to proceed in each of the departments, or one of the departments, or whatever your decision ends up being. I think all the needs, we wouldn't have brought the needs to you if we didn't think they were credible and needy and worthy. But as I said at the beginning, we only have so much money. Now, we try not to let that stop us from doing good work. So we'll try to get resourceful and creative. And Rhonda has a few ideas. I have a few ideas. But before we finish that out, I did at least invite Angela back to say, hey, you gave a great overview of your capital needs. As you sat through these last police, fire, service, anybody else I'm missing? They talked a lot more about, hey, here's our operating needs, staffing in particular. So I said to her, I wasn't quite speak now or forever hold your peace, but it was kind of that idea, like, hey, look, if you do have some, I know you presented some capital needs. And she was very gracious about, like, I already have a big ask on the table with my capital needs. You really want me to roll out with operating needs? I don't want to seem too greedy here. And I said, no, it's not about that. It's simply, you kind of need to bookmark where you're at, and we need to understand the full context. And she'll also, I'm not trying to steal her thunder, but in our conversations, we discussed, look, once you get your capital projects rolling, you may have more staffing needs to serve those facilities. And she's the first to say, yeah, and I'm not really going to project that or ask for that until we're on that path. So this isn't the end. It's true for any of the departments. I mean, there's always things that change, but for now, she had a fairly limited, I think, at least last time we talked, a fairly limited sort of ask on the annual staffing side, operating side. So I just wanted to give her a chance to kind of explain that to you, because it'll be, presumably, we'll have it on your worksheet at some point, and I want you at least to know what the heck that line is. So, Angela?
Thank you.
How are you?
Good evening. So as Dave mentioned, I was here a few months ago and had passed out a five-year and beyond plan of Kent Parks and Recreation capital needs. And tonight I'm here to discuss operating and staffing, as he mentioned, and not to sound like a broken record, but just to kind of reiterate some ideas that have already been discussed in the past. Parks and Rec, our revenue sources, were funded by user fees, which are fees that we charge for rentals of our facilities and registrations for our programs. And we're also funded by multiple very small tax levies. And those tax levies, just as a reminder, they do not increase from year to year. They collect the same amount of money that they did the year they were passed. And most of those, I believe, are now 10 to 15 years old. As you can imagine, our staffing costs increase from year to year, our operating costs increase from year to year, and that revenue collection does not. And we're also very mindful with our charging of our user fees. It's very important to this community, to our department, and to the Parks and Recreation Board that we stay reasonable and affordable for the people in this community to be able to participate in our programs. So we're a little bit limited there as well. Our second largest source of revenue after our tax collections is our before and after school care programs, our preschool and our summer camps. And those generate approximately $400,000 on an annual basis. So for those of you who do not know this lady to my right, this is Megan Johns. She is our recreation specialist. She's celebrating her 20th year with the city this year. And she oversees the programs that I just mentioned. So we work very closely together on a daily basis, and we identify the needs in that program, how we can grow that program, and what we can do to better serve that program. And one of the ways that we feel is very, very important to discuss is that since COVID, we've seen a continuous increase in child behavioral issues, IEPs, which are individual education plans, 501 plans, behavioral, medical, physical care plans. 30% of our registrants in that program are coming to us with some known form of a medical need or a behavior condition. The need for inclusion has become vital in these programs. And when Megan started, I mean, this was a background, and any of this was not a requirement for her job position. So we feel that we really, really need to serve that area with someone who's qualified. I can tell you firsthand, just from observing all the years now since post-COVID, Megan doesn't have the time. She doesn't have the time to meet with 30 different families, you know, parent meetings. We are a liaison between families and the Kent Police Department with their juvenile diversion officer. We work closely with her as well. Currently, we're covering these areas with three part-time people, and we're seeing that the problems we're running into are availability of these three part-time people because they have full-time jobs. They give us very limited time. They give us the time that they can, but we're finding it's just not enough. And the inconsistency when working with families and them always having to deal with a different person is proving to work not in our favor as well. As a result of our master plan study, we found Kent Parks and Rec fell below the benchmark of having 14 full-time staff members. We have 10, and 5 of those are dedicated to maintenance only. So we do have 5 on the administrative side and just 1 full-time person who's overseeing the programs that we're discussing right now. Our entire child care staff is part-time. They work at the rec center, they work at Davie Elementary, they work out of the Roy Smith Shelter House for our preschool, and then they're spread among 4 different sites for different camps and in the summertime. With the creation of a full-time program and behavior support coordinator, they'll be able to solely focus on the following areas: medical, behavioral, staff training, parent meetings, being the primary liaison with Kent Police Department, juvenile counselor, and grant writing. So we're asking for the consideration of funding this position full-time. The total cost would be just a little less than $90,000. That's a $56,000 annual salary, and then that includes benefits on top of that as well. The Park Board is in support of the creation of this position as well. And if this were to move forward, the 3 part-time positions that are currently trying to help cover this now would be eliminated. So we wouldn't have a need for those positions any longer. Funding this would provide much needed relief to our operating budget and reduce the projected shortfall between our expenses and our revenue. To 2026, I just met with Rhonda and Brian in budget and finance last week. And right now our shortfall is projected to be around 400,000. And that's not very different from this year. I mean, this year we had just about the same projection. Luckily we don't come in at those numbers. We're very mindful with our spending. We've been mindful trying to acquire grants, trying to increase revenue where we can and reduce our costs where we can. So right now I think we're closing that gap from now to the end of the year with, I think, about maybe less than 120,000 of that projection. So while this aids our operating budget and unfortunately doesn't allow for the addition of new capital projects, and I know that's kind of a separate discussion, and if there's any way that council would have any kind of considerations for funding any of the capital projects on that side as well. I think in the handout that I had provided when I was here to talk about capital, 2026, we have $497,000 worth of capital needs for next year. And that didn't even include anything flashy other than a new mower. The rest of it was pretty much ongoing maintenance. And out of that $497,000, we have $120,000 budgeted for next year. So that still leaves $377,000 of capital needs that we do not have funded at this point in time. There have been some ideas kind of kicked around in my conversations with Dave, and they included council having discussions and possibly setting a percentage aside from the income tax collections that the city gets, which add up to about, I believe it's $20 million annually. Maybe 1% of that would be $200,000, which would be very helpful to a department such as Parks and Recreation. And I know there's been discussion, our capital items are budgeted as a continuation. They fall under our operating, under the Parks and Rec budget. We're not part of the big city book, the big 5-year capital plan. And there's been some discussion about maybe moving us into that with the other departments. And so all of our capital projects are kind of lumped together, and maybe we approach that a little bit differently. So I think both of those ideas were great ideas and maybe provide further or require further discussion. But I know that's something that you would have to discuss among yourselves.
She's starting to think, get ahead into the November discussion. That's exactly the kind of things we're going to come back to you and say, here's some things that you could consider. Both of which I do think, not trying to get out in front of it, but I think it's probably time to have a very serious discussion about including them in the cap plan, because, you know, we're always underfunded, but the capital plan itself creates a level of discipline and optimization that's not as available when you're scrambling every year to be like, well, how much money left is going to be left that I can use for capital? And that's not, I mean, the good news is this city has not used that strategy, but a lot of cities, that is what happens. And the fact that the charter has that 25% set aside really drives that, because that's every, the income tax as it comes in, 25% is set aside for capital. And that's what the success of that led me to think, you know, maybe we need to have a conversation of doing something similar to that for Parks and Rec, where we just say 1% of the city's income tax, as long as we're in financial health, will be set aside for Parks and Rec capital to start building a fund. Anyways, now I'm doing it. I'm getting ahead. Those are discussions for next month. I just want to share, you know, share some of that with you. Something else I was going to say. Again, the needs are more than we can afford. So it's going to take thoughtful, strategic conversations and to optimize what we got. And kind of, if nothing else, I think the goal is to get, put Parks and Rec, put each of the departments, so particularly Parks and Rec, on a path to get out of this eventually, right? Like, I don't think, I said this to her, I said, we're not going to be able to just wave some magic wand and fix all your problems in one night. It's true for all the departments that presented. And they've all been very appreciative of the opportunity to kind of make the pitch. Usually they come to us, make the pitch, and Rhonda says, no, next. So, you know, we're kind of, I'm joking, but I'm kind of not. Like, that is sort of the filter we use internally, but this is bigger than that filter. Like, because these are fundamental, some of these are fundamental issues, public safety, quality of life, Parks and Rec programming, and the services they provide. And actually, some of the stuff that she's referring to specific to this position really reminds me of the same conversation we're having with the police department, that the nature of policing has changed because you're doing so much more. I'm almost calling it social work or mental health work. People in the community. Mm-hmm. And so it's no longer rolling on the scene, making an arrest and going. It's negotiating, it's assessing, referring, following up. And that's kind of the same issues that they're finding in their programming. And so this is kind of where the, you know, it's the state of people today. And so whether it's people that get in the law or people that are in programs that Parks and Rec offers. So it is a shift kind of that we're seeing, and we're trying to respond to that in a constructive way for our community. It is a bit more social worky maybe than traditionally, but that seems to be what cities are moving into, because that's the probably some of the most pressing needs. And those needs, if not met somehow, become such a burden on the other programs like policing and Parks and Rec, that you start to diminish their ability to serve and provide those programs. So that's why we're, I don't mean to get on a, you understand the issue. So that sort of wraps up. If you have any questions, we're happy to answer, but that was the end of the needs discussion, and we'll come back.
So you're going to come back in November
next month.
Things. Does anybody have any questions? I guess that's it.
I invited Megan. Was there anything you wanted to ask? Yes. Are you going to? Okay, good.
Actually, for the position that you're looking to fill, what is the, like, what would be the title of it, like potential title of it, and then some of the potential qualifications that you would be looking for, just to give me an understanding?
So it's a little bit of a mouthful, but we really, really, we're very careful in selecting the words in this title. It is Program and Behavior Support Coordinator.
And then what type of qualifications or experience are you, like, hoping to get in the county?
We kind of compared this position to an intervention specialist in a classroom setting or a school setting. Right now, the part-time people that I have in the position are full-time classroom teachers or speech pathologists. So something in that realm as well. But yeah, definitely somebody that can work with the medical conditions, the mental health, behavioral health, things like that.
So it's not like a position that requires a certification or advanced degrees or something. You've got a little bit of wiggle room there, and candidates based on experience, not necessarily like really strict like degree.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks. I was just curious.
But some of that would help.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, I'm sure that would help. Yeah.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you. Very good.
Thank you. Okay. Land Use Committee. There's nothing health and safety, so Land Use Committee, Vice Chair.
Great.
Bridget's back.
Yeah.
She's got some more information following up on the conversations on the overlay concept and some of the particularly more details on the environmental conditions of the site.
I just want everybody to see the table. So yes, as Dave mentioned, this is a follow-up to the discussion we had last month that came out of the Don't watch my laptop won't work. I got it right working for Julie, but mine's not going to work.
There it goes.
Just a minute. Once I get it up, I won't have to deal with it again. And I put it on my laptop, but of course it looks so much smaller on my. It is. Okay. So when we council voted to deny the request for the rezone to the R3 and to maintain the industrial district, staff though did want to present council with all the options that are available under our zoning code, which includes the overlay district in our chapter 1104. We have one existing overlay which covers our downtown area, which we have design regulations and design guidelines. But there is language in there that allows for overlays to be used. It maintains the existing zoning beneath it and then has criteria above it for specific projects. I mentioned the topic, but you will remember I did reference that the overlay, if it was going to be considered and approved by council, it should require it not go into effect until a no further action covenant not to sue is put in place for the site to residential standards. So brownfield cleanups have different standards, and we have worked on several brownfields. So I have all the projects that were brownfields that we worked on here in the city, just to give you some context of the complexities and the variables that play into this. The first one was Jerry's Cleaners 1002.
I'm sorry, can I ask you to zoom in a little bit?
Sure.
For the audience.
Sure. Let me get my glasses to do that. Hang on a second. But there, I got it. I'm just trying to, is that better? I have hard copies too, if anyone needs these. So the first project is 1002 Franklin, which was the former Jerry's Cleaners site. This assessment started in 2009 and it was completed in 2012. It was only completed because the federal EPA came in and took over. As we worked through, if anyone was familiar with this building, it was tiny. It was a very small parcel. Unfortunately, the chlorinated solvents that have about a 30-letter word that is shortened to the acronym PERC had been poured directly into the grout. This chemical does not break down on its own. So 30 cubic yards of soil had to be removed. And the only reason we had the federal EPA come in and assist with this at that time was because it was in an area of high concentration, low income housing right next to it, and because there was a grade school across the street. Had those variables not been in place, this dry cleaner likely would not have been cleaned up unless we had some other financial assistance. There is an existing vapor intrusion remediation required on abutting properties. One refused to actually include it, and the federal government cannot force them to do it. The other one did. You may be familiar with what is like with radon. So that was what was used to this to ensure that the vapors that would get trapped in the basement layer would be ventilated out properly. That was just to bring that property to commercial industrial standards, and it has actually been sold as a side lot through a partnership with our county land bank, and will not be available for residential redevelopment at any time. The next one was 627 Lake Street, the former Amatech site. For those of you, I'm just going to give you a brief background, but Dan Smith, Dave Roller, and I did a lot of moving chairs to get Ametek downtown, and part of that was taking on the Ametek site. So we took that on, and we were fortunate enough to get a CORF grant, Clean Ohio Revitalization Fund, which is the equivalent of a brownfield grant. This was actually, we were one of the last ones to get the CORF program before the state suspended the program for almost a decade. So with that project, we started the assessment in 2011. The project completion was not until 2018. This project had asbestos remediation in the demolition. If you remember, the developer mentioned that that issue was addressed and complete within the first year. The rest was dealing with chlorinated solvents in the ground. This was a bit of a moving target. We had vapor intrusions that we were dealing with. And in the process of this project, we were nearing completion, still in active remediation, but nearing completion. The EPA changed the standards of a certain chemical that we were removing from 1,000 points per billion or 2,000 points per billion to 400. Our scientists, they're called certified professionals. We call them CP for short. They have basically qualifications and certifications from the Ohio EPA to do voluntary action plan cleanup. So they are the only, if you're not a certified professional, a CP, you cannot write a remediation plan that will result in a no further action covenant not to sue. So based on that, he said, we will be long gone and we could be pulling out of the ground and we'll never get to that level. So we actually still control and own a small flag parcel on that site. We were able to sell the parcel to Smithers because we held that, the EPA gave us through a land covenant, the EPA gave us a no further action covenant not to sue. And what that means in layman's terms is if you have that, it's your golden ticket. You can now sell that property and never be required to do any additional remediation. You have met the federal and state standards for cleanup. So that took us 7.5 years. I remember when I reached out to Dave, I said, we actually got it. He's like, really? Like, because, you know, it just was, we never thought we'd get there. Again, that was to get it to commercial industrial standards. So no project have we worked on to get to residential. And this is how long these have taken. The next one, the 800 Mogador Road site. The city is not an active participant in this voluntary action plan, but this brownfield, we almost were. We almost took this on for a dollar back in 2011. There was some language in, I had just started in my role as interim, and there was some language that gave me pause. And the defensive positioning of the property owner at that time, just my gut told us we shouldn't. Dave agreed, so did Jim Silver, our law director, we didn't. And 2 years later, the emergency EPA was on that site and they told us that was the best decision we ever made. It is still under active remediation. There's a new ownership structure there that since 2017, and I will tell you it has been very helpful working with them. We've had a lot of challenges with that site, and they have been working to get it cleaned up, and they're very cooperative and collaborative, and obviously we're working with them on the solar array on that site. That remediation is ongoing. So it has plateaued.
You tell me recently they spent, so far they've spent how much in millions?
Well, just on the North Ditch remediation, that was an extra, that was a $3.6 million unknown, and then the river cleanup was close to $10 million. And that's still, there's still costs they're incurring for active remediation on the site. To the south, there is a, we call it a slurry wall, and there's a cap. It's around they were open pits of chlorinated solvents. That was actually taken care of. And in 2011, when the city was looking at taking a CORF grant to potentially and buy that property for a dollar, it was because that slurry wall had failed and some of the chlorinated solvents were leaking out. All of the focus from the property owner at that time was that the work that we needed to get the CORF grant to do was all centered on the south side. I'm a loser, and I actually read the study, the grant application, and it referenced something on the north side and asked about it, and apparently I wasn't supposed to look there. And it turns out most of the issues we have now actually are on the north side, which is why we're putting the solar array over there, because you can install a solar array because we don't have people. There's very low migration into the ground. So this is going to be a win-win for the property. And when they get to the point that they secure the NFA and the covenant not to sue, the city can then move from a lease situation, which will be working to structure, which will have some complexities. So I'll be in front of you, I'm sure often, to actually acquire it, but not until we get the covenant not to sue and the no further action. They should be able to proceed for the no further action letter, which basically is the first step. In about 2020, late 2026 to 2027. So if we are already ongoing since 2012, we are not looking for an NFA on that site for probably a good 15 years since start. The final one is 300 Rockwell, which is also known as the former Triangle Cleaner site. So the building itself was removed before Dave and I both were here. And it turned out, I always use this analogy and I'm gonna use it here. It reminded me of Poltergeist. They took the tombstones, but they left the graves. That was a little bit of what we had here. And it was unbeknownst to me. We were actually, for those of you that do not know, the city owns the parking lot that on us, the water facility on the east side of Gogler uses. It's completely fenced in. They have unfettered complete access. The day I was to come to council for that to be sold, I received the phase one from the property owner and he said, we're not buying it. There had been migration of chlorinated solvents, which is a dry cleaning chemical, across Gogler and into that parking lot. So we ended up entering into a lease agreement. We wanted on us to open and we worked with them to get that deal. Meanwhile, I had assessment work done. We had to drill wells 87 feet down in that parking lot because they pull water from an aquifer 115 feet down. We needed to see how far in the bedrock was the concern and issue. Oh, and let's not forget the river was just further east. So we had concerns. At this time, the state actually in 2021 and in effect put it in effect for 2022, initiated new money called Brownfield Grant. So we had the assessment. So I applied and we were fortunate. We secured $330,000 for the cleanup of that site. We used Brownfield Restoration Group, the same CP that we used on the Amatech site. And basically, because we were dealing with bedrock and, you know, chlorinated solvents, the perk, it never breaks down. It's their source pool. So it's hard to get all of it and it can cling to soil and to bedrock. So we actually injected carbon, kind of like became like a foam in there and stopped it in its tracks. I mean, it's like, I feel like I'm on a commercial, like, you know, just stopped it in its tracks. It worked. So we were pleased it worked. And we prepared the certified professional prepared the no further action letter and submitted it on June 25th. We had what's basically a meeting where the EPA looks at that and asks questions. At that meeting, a change in an EPA rule in February of this year to look at a chemical that was not required to be assessed or looked at a scope or level when the site was done in 2021 when we did the assessment. They want us now to do the assessment even though the remediation is done. So the NFA may not be coming. I'm working on this with our certified professional. We are hopeful we can find a path forward, but this also means that I can't draw down the last of the remaining funds because the grant, the Ohio Department of Development is requiring that we have an NFA and a covenant not to sue in place before I can draw the last 10%. So there's basically 34,000 on hold and potentially more cost, sorry, Rhonda, if we have to do this additional assessment. So basically, we followed all the rules. We tested for everything we were supposed to do in 2022, but because of a rule change in February of 2025, we may not get our NFA. So I'm bringing these up because for me to stand here and be able to tell you at what time and place we are going to be able to say that an NFA to residential standards, which cannot happen until we reach commercial industrial standards on the two Davy Drill sites, is something that I can't stand here in good conscience or as a professional and say. I can tell you it will be long. If this is what we've experienced with commercial industrial standards, which have to be met based on the grant that that's currently been issued or given to the land bank for that site has to be met first. And then a new assessment to meet residential standards and a plan have to be met and approved, created. It is going to be some years. I also want to point out in this discussion, I know it's a little bit of a shift, but it's still under the sun of the same topic. One of the things that Dave and I, after our meeting, discussed on our way out is, it's really important that we get that $1.3 million land bank grant. We cannot let that go. This grant did have a 25% match commitment. So Dave and I approached Hometown and said, we don't want it associated with any specific project, but we think it's important, and we are willing to ask council to provide half of the match in order to ensure that Hometown can feel comfortable signing the escrow agreement for the 25% match. It's a $1.3 million grant, just over. The match is a $438,000 commitment, so roughly the city's portion would be $220,000. That commitment is not doesn't need to be complete in 1 year because the match is given when an invoice happens. So the invoice for the work that the certified professional, which is Brownford Restoration Group, BRG, will come in. The grant will cover 75%. And then the match. So we would appropriate that over the course of probably at least a 3 year period. But we do think that because of the high levels, and I do have that map too, if you do not remember that, of where we have the contamination on that site. I don't like.
So the rush is doing that. So the point of this is, you asked us to kind of engage in a thought experiment. Is there a reasonable path with the idea of an overlay? Because we want to make sure you knew you had the option, but just having the option doesn't mean you should do it, right? You asked us to come back, should we or should we not? Does it make sense? And you know, we're not trying to take sides in this, but what we're saying is, from a practical perspective, every situation we've had has been 3 to 5 to 8 to 10 years just to get commercial industrial standards. And so we can't in good conscience suggest to you that getting to residential standards is going to certainly be no shorter than that, undoubtedly longer. And we just think that from our perspective, that's not a particularly practical to tie that property up with just in the hope someday we can get to this standard, which could be 10, 15, 20 years. I think that's why if it seems like we're boring you to death with these details, it's because we think the details of the environmental work cause us to say to you, I think you need to pass on the overlay district. It's not practical. Not that it can't be done, it's just not practical in this circumstance. And so we wanted to lay that out very clearly. That's why she's gone to the level of detail. And as you look on the map, that case gets stronger because you see the hot spots.
Yeah.
This is a large site that had rail and a lot of activity in an era when, you know, regulations may not have been what they are, certainly were not what they are today. And practices, standard practices were very different. And as she said, we've got $1.3 million in hand. We've identified, she and I talked, and we talked to Rhonda about what funding source we have, the money we could use, and sort of in categories that as a surplus, we don't have a surplus anywhere, but specifically for like economic development, okay? So we have a fund that's sort of set up for that. And there's enough of a balance in there that this warrants that. It checks all the boxes, putting our money in the deal to make sure we don't lose the $1.3 million. It ensures the residents will get protection because we're going to clean it up. It gives us the opportunity to repurpose the property for whatever you end up deciding to repurpose it for. We had a whole bunch of boxes.
Because also, too, this exceeds commercial industrial standards right now. That needs to be made clear. This does not meet the standards. So the remediation action plan is to get this to the EPA standards for commercial industrial. This here is showing you basically all the hotspots of where soil remediation would need to occur. So some of the six steps in the remediation plan that the EPA approved on the voluntary action plan for this site, and they include land covenants, which require that no residential use and some enclosed commercial use occur on those sites. So soil will be remediated, and there's other remediation steps will be done, but some of the way to get to the no further action will be that some of those areas that are, you know, they all stand for five different chemicals, right? Chemicals of concerns. And some of those will not be brought to the level to get it. So there'll be a land covenant. Nothing goes over this, or you have to put a parking lot over it. So, and right now, the green are basically getting it to the commercial standards. To get it to residential, every one of those dots is red. Every one of them. So there's some serious, I mean, I have done the brownfields that we saw here, and I worked on a couple when I was at Summit County. There are more chemicals of concern listed in this than I've dealt with on other sites. We have arsenic, mercury, you know, lead. We've got a lot of things going on. And again, for commercial industrial, we're going to take out maybe 2 feet of soil in certain spots. Some spots we're never going to get even with that. To get to a residential, it's a minimum of 10 feet, right? And it could be more. Look what happened on the dry cleaning site. So the message we want to say is the complexities associated with a brownfield site and putting a potentially limiting future application on it could create issues where even developing it to industrial standards would be a challenge. So I could take questions.
Are there any questions for Bridget?
So thank you for this detailed information. And I think you make a compelling case that actually thinking about a residential overlay not only is not in anyone's best interest, but actually puts Hometown Bank, the owner of the property, at a kind of in a limbo state. I do want to understand, though, if we, the city, are going to, if you're going to ask us to come up with half of that 25% match, how are we going to come up with the other portion of that?
So Hometown is going to provide the other match.
So Hometown,
yes,
is going to
and
do
they
the
agreed that it would not be associated with any specific project. They too agree that cleaning up the site and getting a no further action covenant not sue commercial industrial is appropriate. So what would if council were to authorize that, we would work on entering into an agreement with Hometown. Hometown has the grant with Land Bank, right, and we'll be signing the escrow agreement. So then we would basically go into an agreement with them to basically cover half the match as those match requests come in for the draws against the grant.
So do we need to make a motion to abandon the look into the overlay? Is it something that needs to be motioned? I'll make that motion then to abandon the look into the overlay district.
All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed?
And then a vote on the match.
Is there a second motion?
I'll move the match.
Anybody want to speak to the motion?
I think, relatively speaking, the match is not a huge amount of money that, if we can get that site up and running in some capacity in the future, should hopefully pay us back on it.
Great.
I just want to say, I think that it's important for the community that we've made this commitment and that whoever ends up on it eventually, we've done the right thing for the community by cleaning it up. And so I appreciate how everybody worked together on this process.
Would you like to go to the audience? Absolutely. Any comments or questions from the audience? Yeah, please come to the mic, state your name and address, and we'll give you 3 minutes. Please give your name and address,
okay,
and we'll give you 3 minutes.
Sorry, this is my first time here.
No,
so
that's okay. You're doing great.
But my name is Gabriela Vasquez, and I live in 3769 Cascades Boulevard, which, crazily enough, it's still Kent. My question is, for all these like piece of land, I keep hearing there's this specific chemicals that come from like dry cleaning, right?
Not on this side.
Not on this one. Okay. So just overall, like, my question is, if this chemicals that did come from dry cleanings, like, are they like prohibited to use anymore? Or like, is it going to be like something that maybe right now is this piece of land, but then if there's another dry cleaning running, like, is it going to keep happening? That's my question.
Sure, that's a good question. Actually, the dry cleaning chemical is highly regulated. Unfortunately, the two small dry cleaners we had in the city, the business owners were not following those regulations. At the one, they were literally dumping it into the soil. You're not allowed to do that.
Right.
Just like you're not allowed to dump things down, you know, the catch basins, things like that. So that's why we had those situations. Unfortunately, rule, you know, many decades ago, either people didn't know better or it was just, you know, not monitored well. So at this point, though, that is highly monitored now.
Okay.
So we cleaned up the two that were problematic. So.
Thank you. Other comments or questions from the audience on the motion? Yep.
I'm Zane Hawkins. I live at 1479 Ridgecrest Drive.
First, I want to say thank you to all of you for your stewardship to the community and serving your community. Second, I want to say the scouting community will greatly miss Mayor Fiala. He was always more than gracious to come to scout meetings and help instill stewardship in the community and our civic duty to the youth of Kent. I also want to say that I'm a lifelong Kentite and a Rough Rider. By no small part of the retired educators in the room and not present, Mr. Amrein and Mr. Sidoti. Even when I was away serving under the ocean and submarines, I always was a Rough Rider at heart. I'm going to amend my comments because I was coming here to speak against the overlay district, but I also want you to support contributing city funds to the abatement of the site. I'll go ahead and read my comments to you. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I'm here to voice strong opposition to the proposed rezoning of the historic Kent Rail Yard, also known as the former Davy Drill site, into a residential overlay district. Kent's identity is inseparable from this site. The town itself was named in honor of Marvin Kent, who brought the Atlantic and Great Western Railroad to Franklin Mills in 1863. This rail infrastructure transformed Kent into a regional industrial hub, catalyzing the growth of Portage County. The rail yard was once the largest employer in Kent, predating Kent State University. Its historical significance is documented extensively by the Kent Historical Society and celebrated in local events. This same site, which later housed Davy Drill, is a historically industrial property and recognized to be a brownfield site. It has known soil and groundwater contamination from decades of industrial use, including by the Erie Railroad and Davy Drill. And while remediation funds have been secured, cleanup is targeted to industrial standards, not residential. While remediation funds have been secured, converting this land for residential use would require significantly more remediation, likely infeasible given the site's contamination profile and cost. Risk-based brownfield cleanups often leave contamination in place, relying on land use restrictions to limit exposure. Residential development introduces unavoidable risks. Children playing in yards, digging in soil, and being exposed to residual toxins. The EPA itself warns that brownfields may contain lead, arsenic, petroleum, and PFAs, which pose long-term health risks. Even with overlays and institutional controls, the reality is that full remediation to residential standards is rare and unreliable. Industrial zoning supports creation of jobs in sectors that pay living wages. Open Machine, for example, has invested over $15 million in Kent South End and maintains a $3 million annual payroll. These are jobs that allow people to live and thrive in Kent, not just commute from elsewhere. The city's job creation tax credit program incentivizes industrial employers to expand locally, creating sustainable employment. Residential development, while addressing housing demand, often results in lower wages, lower wage service jobs, and increased infrastructure strain. It also risks displacing future industrial opportunities that could revitalize Kent's economy and honor its legacy. Rezoning this historic contaminated site for residential use is not just environmentally irresponsible, it's economically short-sighted. Kent has an opportunity to preserve its industrial heritage, protect public health, and foster meaningful job creation. Let's not trade our legacy and future for short-term developmental gains. Keep the zoning industrial. Reject the overlay district. And I hope that you support funding this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Zane. We have a statement that Kathy will read from Roger Thurman.
Yes, this is a statement from a resident who couldn't be here tonight, but he wanted this on the record. Dear Kent City Council, a gathering met recently at the library to discuss the proposed 102-unit residential rental development at the former Davy Drill location. The 411 member group participates in the Save the Old Kent Railroad Car Shop on Facebook. The few who are able to attend in person are passionately versed in and proud of Kent's rich history embodied by the surviving cut sandstone buildings built in 1865 by Marvin Kent for his Atlantic and Great Western Railroad, which catapulted Franklin Mills, later Kent, into national and international renown. His son, William S. Kent, with impeccable timing, donated the land that became Kent State University, which is a knowledge factory of incalculable value to this community. The core 1865 Marvin Kent Railroad buildings in question will be destroyed by the proposed development that is out of sync with the single-family residences that characterize the pleasant South End neighborhood where I've lived and worked for over 50 years. We all recognize the classic enduring beauty of our 1876 triple arch stone bridge downtown spanning the Cuyahoga River. How did our little community at that time exert itself to construct at considerable expense such a vital asset? Perhaps it saw the Kent Mansion and the iconic train station, and yes, the beautiful and massive cut stone railroad maintenance edifices, which are now covered by 1950s mundane industrial additions. Marvin Kent built with aesthetic style, vision, and durability, the highest standards that are plainly evident to this day. At our Kent History Buffs meeting, almost everyone spoke. People offered examples of other cities which created a successful development that prepared preserved a historic structure at the center of attraction. Kent's A&GW Railroad, later the Erie, is iconic to railroad history, and that alone will attract outside interest and investment to encourage preservation. We're not anti-development. Finding a developer willing to rehabilitate and preserve the monuments as the centerpiece of an industrial or residential development is not unrealistic or fanciful. It's been done elsewhere. We don't want to have these valuable historic buildings destroyed because of an artificial hurry-up timeline detrimental to the community, but very profitable for the bank and outside venture capital money. Theirs is not the only venture capital money available, let's not forget. Let us consider this carefully and not render an awkward, hasty decision. Perhaps the present developer could be encouraged to rethink their plan. We all need to work together to arrive at a workable, creative outcome that does justice to Marvin Kent's enduring, defining vision for this community. We are tilling the rich soil of Kent history. Respectfully, Roger Thurman.
Thank you. Are there any other comments from our intrepid audience? If not, we'll go back to council. There is a motion on the table. Jeff, can you restate your motion?
Yeah, my motion is to approve the city paying half the match for the grant.
Great. Second by Mike. Okay. Great. We'll call a vote. All those in favor of the motion?
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Thank you. It passes.
Okay. That's it for the committee. And I need someone to move an executive session.
I'll move it.
Second.
We need to read
the thing. Would you please read it, Jeff?
Yeah. I'd like to move an executive session to consider the appointment, employment, dismissal, discipline, promotion, demotion, or compensation of a public employee or official and property acquisition.
Seconded by Gwen. All those in favor?
Aye.
Roll call. Kathy, would you read roll call, please?
Ms. Silka?
Yes.
Mr. Clapper?
Yes.
Mr. DeLeon?
Yes.
Mr. Hook?
Yes.
Ms. Rosenberg?
Yes.
Ms. Schaefer-Bish? Mr. Sidoti, Mr. Turner, Mr. Amrine.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Move to excuse Roger, Heidi, and Robin. I don't know if we have to do that, but
we did that already.
We already did that, so we're okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Why don't we take 5 minutes to clear the audience, and then we'll go into executive session. Oh, that's right. We can go. You can all stay. We just go to a separate room. I'm too. You
really bad. Except to.
Right. Yeah, we won't. You can stay, but we won't be coming.
You too.
Good night, Dave.
Way better than last year's. It was crazy last year. There was interviews beforehand for permission. There was this stuff. There was people that just, you know, came and didn't want to speak on topic. They just wanted to talk. They had to be told to sit down. Yes.
Yep.
You too. Right, yeah, they just make a motion to adjourn. Stairs. Thank you.